From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Another whistleblower was sentenced to a U.S. prison Monday. Jeffrey Sterling, a former CIA officer, was sentenced to 3.5 years on espionage charges for telling a journalist for the New York Times about a secret U.S. operation to disrupt Iran's nuclear program. Sterling had argued that the law under which he was charged, the Espionage Act, which was passed during World War I, was intended to prosecute spies, not whistleblowers. He asked for leniency, as was shown to retired General David Petraeus, who received probation for his disclosure of highly classified materials. Prosecutors had instead sought a sentence of 20 years or more in prison. Sterling's case revolves around an operation in which a former Russian scientist provided Iran with intentionally flawed nuclear component schematics. Sterling was convicted in January of revealing the operation to James Risen, a reporter for the New York Times, who had revealed the operation in his book, State of War. Prosecutors said Sterling, who was black, had a vendetta against the CIA, which he had sued for racial discrimination, and that he released the information out of spite. In explaining the sentence, Judge Leonie Brinkema said Monday that the information revealed in State of War had jeopardized the safety of a CIA informant. The U.S. is fond of lecturing, sanctioning, and even bombing those countries it accuses of violating the human rights of its citizens or others. On Monday, however, it was the U.S. in the dock at the U.N.'s Human Rights Council for the 22nd session of the Universal Periodic Review. That process involves a review of the human rights records of all U.N. member states under the auspices of the Human Rights Council, which provides the opportunity for each state to declare what actions they've taken to improve the human rights situations in their countries and to fulfill their human rights obligations. As one of the main features of the Council, the Universal Periodic Review is designed to ensure equal treatment for every country when their human rights conditions are assessed. More than 50 nations spoke Monday on the human rights situation in the U.S. We bring you now the comments from some of those countries who are most often lectured by the U.S. on human rights. This was the representative from Nicaragua.
Señor Presidente, Nicaragua da la
Mr. President, Nicaragua would like to welcome the delegation of the United States and thanks it for presenting its report and recommends that the U.S. ratify international human rights instruments, which it is not yet a state party to. Abolish the death penalty in the states where it is still practiced, put an end to sanctions and unilateral coercive measures which infringe upon the sovereignty, self-determination, and full exercise of all human rights imposed on countries in all the regions of the world, and also guarantee the exercise of all human rights by minorities and existing vulnerable groups in the country, including indigenous peoples and migrants. And lastly, shoulder in a spirit of shared but differentiated responsibility the commitment to work together with the international community to tackle the world problem of climate change and its adverse impact. Thank you.
This was the representative from the Russian Federation.
Thank you. We have carefully studied the national report of the U.S. as well as alternative reports. Unfortunately, we have to point out that the authorities of the country manifestly have not paid sufficient attention to the recommendations provided during the first cycle of the UPR. We would also note that the human rights situation in the country has seriously deteriorated recently. The government of the U.S. must take urgent measures to improve the situation. We recommend first that it ensure independent and objective investigations into all cases of police arbitrary behavior, including murders, torture, arbitrary detention, the use of military equipment, and the seizure of property. Second, that it provide effective legal and procedural guarantees against the collection and use by security services of personal information. This includes abroad. Third, that it immediately close the Guantanamo prison and cease illegal detention of terrorism suspects at its military bases abroad. Four, that it stop extrajudicial killings of U.S. citizens and foreigners, including those being committed with the use of unmanned aircraft. Fifth, that it conduct impartial and objective investigations into all cases of the cruel treatment of adopted children and to eliminate impunity for such crimes. Sixth, that it stop the practice of racial profiling in judicial and law enforcement systems. Seventh, that it withdraw all reservations to human rights treaties internationally and implement provisions conscientiously. Eighth.
This was the representative from Uruguay.
Thank you, Mr. President. Uruguay welcomes the delegation of the United States and would like to particularly point to the efforts made in the area of human rights education. We commend the measures adopted to combat all forms of discrimination and encourage the country to step up efforts in this area. In this connection, we would recommend that it avoid the criminalization of migrants. We welcome the fact that the number of states applying the capital punishment continues to drop. And in line with this trend, Uruguay recommends that a moratorium be placed on the death penalty with a view to its abolition once and for all in all states. We'd also recommend that the U.S. consider in a positive way the signing and ratification of the core international and inter-American human rights instruments, and also reconsider the reservations and declarations placed on them, and raise the minimum age for voluntary enlistment in armed forces at 18 and explicitly criminalize as an offense any violation of the provisions of the optional protocol to the Convention on the Rights of the Child on the participation of children in armed conflict. Thank you.
This was the representative from Venezuela.
Concerning the situation of human rights in the United States, we'd recommend that the country ratify all human rights international conventions and their protocols of the ILO and the Rome, and also the conventions of the ILO and the Rome Statute, that it repeal the interventionist decree against Venezuela and the unilateral coercive measures imposed on sovereign countries, that it respect the sovereignty and free self-determination of Venezuela, that it extradite Luis Posada Carriles and other terrorists requested by Venezuela, that it punish perpetrators of torture, the murders with drones and the use of lethal force against African Americans, that it provide compensation to the victims, that it close Guantanamo and secret detention facilities, that it stop spying on communications and private information throughout the world, that it repeal the slavery amendment vis-a-vis farm workers, particularly women and children, that it decree obligatory maternity leave and equality of pay between men and women, and the creator of a national human rights institution in accordance with the Paris Principles. Thank you.
This was the representative from the People's Republic of China.
The Chinese delegation welcomes the U.S. delegation to the UPR process. China would like to express its concern about some deep-rooted human rights problems in the U.S. and recommend the following. First, it should correctly address the root cause of racial discrimination and eliminate the frequently occurred excessive law enforcement on African ethnics and other minority ethnics. Second, fully disclose the abuse of torture by its intelligence agency, ensure the accountability of the persons responsible, and agree to unrestricted visit by special rapporteur on torture to Guantanamo facilities. Three, stop massive surveillance activities both inside and outside its territory to avoid violating the right to privacy of its citizens and those of other countries. Fourth, respect the indigenous peoples and ethnic minorities' rights and interests, fully consult with them on their land, autonomy, environment, language and other issues, correct historical injustices and offer compensation. Five, ratify as soon as possible ICESCR, the CRC, the CRPD, and CEDAW.
And after being stifled by the U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Samantha Power, last week, the representative from the Democratic People's Republic of Korea finally had his say.
Mr. President, we are gravely concerned at the U.S. violations of human rights, and recommend, one, to investigate the CIA torture crimes, which is sort of indignation and denunciation among people, to disclose all information and to allow investigation by international community in this regard. Two, to take legal and administrative measures to address the civilian killings by the U.S. military troops during and after its invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq by bringing perpetrators to justice and remedying the victims. Three, to put an end to all U.S. military presence in foreign territories, which is the root cause of human rights abuses, including homicide and rape. Four, to take measures to put an end to police abuses, including the merciless killings of colored people and all racial discrimination. And finally, to unconditionally abolish its extraterritorial legislation on human rights and related matters, including the North Korea Human Rights Act. Thank you, Mr. President.
This was the representative from Ecuador.
Ecuador would like to greet the delegation of the United States. We welcome the decisions taken recently aimed at stopping the economic blockade against the Republic of Cuba, which we interpret as a significant step towards the recognition of self-determination and their right and the right of peoples to development. We encourage the country to establish mechanisms which guarantee compensation for victims of torture, cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, and which ensure that those responsible for torture are prosecuted in the courts. We express our concern over the high figures for violence, discrimination, and disproportionate use of force by police officials, above all persons of African descent. We respectfully recommend that the country abolish the death penalty in all states. Second, adopt legislation expanding checks on the personal background for all purchases of firearms. And third, that perpetrators of selective killings through the use of drones which have cost the lives of innocent civilians outside the United States be investigated and prosecuted in the courts. Thank you.
This was the representative from the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Mr. President, the Islamic Republic of Iran welcomes the delegation of the USA to the 22nd UPR Working Group and recommends that the United States ratify the Convention on the Rights of the Child and the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, uphold its obligation to end all forms of racial discrimination in the country, and protect the rights of African Americans against police brutality, take all legal measures to adopt and implement a national racial justice plan consistent with the Durban Declaration and Program of Action, end discrimination in law and practice against all minorities and migrants, particularly against women and children from poor families, and take effective steps to prevent and combat violence against them, investigate torture allegations, extrajudicial execution, and other violations of human rights committed in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, Bagram, Nama, and ballot camps, and to subsequently close them. Mr. President, we are deeply concerned that the definition of racial discrimination used in federal and state legislation and in court practice is not in line with the convention of the ICERD. We call upon the United States to inter alia prohibit racial discrimination.
I'm very sorry. Time is up.
Thank you.
And finally, this was the representative of the plurinational state of Bolivia.
Thank you, Mr. President. The plurinational state of Bolivia thanks the delegation of the United States for complying with the principles of international cooperation laid down in Resolution 3074 regarding extradition of persons accused of crimes against humanity and the extradition of former Bolivian authorities legally charged for their trial in their country of origin, implement the Declaration on Indigenous Peoples, 3, ensure compliance with the human right to water and sanitation according to GA Resolution 64292, abolish the death penalty, prohibit racial profiling by federal authorities and investigate disproportionate use of lethal force against persons of color by the state and local police, review standards to ensure protection against exploitation and forced labor by migrant workers, and ratify all international human rights instruments of which it is not yet a state party. We thank the delegation for submitting the national report. Thank you.
This past weekend, CPR was at the UNAC conference in Secaucus, New Jersey, as activists assembled from around the world to discuss the issue of U.S. wars at home and abroad. Today, we bring you a part of the panel discussion from this weekend's conference entitled Endless Imperial War.
Compañeros and compañeras, brothers and sisters, let's please give a very warm welcome to our compañera and sister in struggle, Susan Abulawa from Palestine. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you all for being here and for inviting me. I wasn't sure what I was going to talk about this morning. But I was telling my friend Betsy Piet about a story, something that happened to me recently, and she suggested I relay it to you, so I'm going to do that. It involves a popular mainstream show, I'm not going to mention what it is, but where people are invited to give a sort of 15-minute talk that presents an idea or a concept or something provocative for people to think about, and it should relate to also personal stories and personal experiences. So I wrote a piece that I was very proud of, and I sent it to her, and it was an immediate refusal. So the topic that I had written about involved, it was my reaction to this sort of pervasive thing in Western discourse that demands of Arabs and Muslims to sort of prove our humanity before we are allowed into the conversation. So you see all these talk show hosts and interviewers who always end up asking us, well, do you support blah, 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 or do you support terrorism? And so this is, it's kind of this initial, you know, prove yourself, prove that you are worthy to be in our company kind of discourse. And it assumes sort of a moral superiority. And the piece that I wrote was provoked by a particular letter that I received that was signed, Sincerely, the Civilized Western World. And yeah, so I wrote a response. I started with a personal story that I'm going to skip, but I do want to read you some of the relevant parts that the show objected to. And they objected to it on the grounds that, first, this isn't something that, you know, the audience really is going to be particularly happy to hear. That was the first thing when I, you know, wrote back that I don't really think of the comfort of the audience when I'm articulating my truth. The next response that came back was, well, it's not a particularly interesting idea and it's not very unique. So I'm going to read it to you, and or at least part of it. And I framed it as a response letter. So it there are phrases in there that read, "Dear Western World." Dear Western World. You have laid waste to cities across continents, terrorized and traumatized whole societies. All are still recovering from your presence in their lands. I came into the world not long after southern poplar trees dangled lifeless black bodies, where entire white Christian families would come out by the thousands to watch and cheer the spectacle of lynchings. I was born toward the end of your foray into Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. The wholesale rape, wanton slaughter of innocents, and extraordinary destruction of the natural world. Following your colonial misadventures, you spared few post-colonial societies from your sense of entitlement to their resources, nor from your contempt and disrespect for their cultures. You allowed none of us to heal or develop our societies. Your endless coups, assassinations, covert and overt violence gave us no peace, no stability long enough to have our own social, scientific, cultural, or economic revolutions. Anytime we liberated ourselves or elected nationalist leaders committed to the welfare of their people, you would kill, depose, and replace them with puppet autocrats who rain terror on their people for your benefit. You did away with Thomas Sankara of Burkina Faso because he advocated for self-sufficiency that threatened your hegemony in the region. You murdered Patrice Lumumba, and with him, the chance that the people of DR Congo might share in the riches of their own land. Then you sent your corporations, your miners, militias, and missionaries to oversee the bloodletting of 6 million Congolese. You murdered Salvador Allende and plunged Chile into torture and misery under your man, Pinochet. You tried your best to kill Fidel. You tried, and maybe you succeeded in killing Hugo Chavez and Yasser Arafat. You did away with Mohammad Mossadegh too, because he insisted that Iranian oil was for the Iranian people, not you. Then you propped up the Shah to do your bidding. The Sykes-Picot Agreement was one you made in secret to divide, manipulate, and rob us in perpetuity. And when it was uncovered by the Bolsheviks, you remained unrepentant, adamant that Arab and Persian oil was there to flow cheaply to you. When the first elected leader of an independent Syria, President Shukri Qautari, advocated for Arab unity and self-determination, you backed a coup to take him out, fledgling that Arab democracy in Syria in ways that reverberate and echo into the unbearable carnage that is Syria today. Osama bin Laden was your man. Saddam Hussein was your man too. You ushered him to power after you got rid of Abdelkarim Qasim, who dared to put Iraqi interests before yours. You brought Saddam to power through an orgy of killing of Iraq's intellectuals, teachers, doctors, scientists, poets, and musicians. When I was a little girl, I lived in Kuwait in an area populated with Palestinian refugees like us and poor workers from other Arab nations. In the apartment across the hall from us lived an Iraqi widow with her children. Kamal, her oldest son, was 18 years old. I was 6, and I expressed my little girl crush on him by throwing fruit peels and mango seeds at him from our window when he walked by. Everyone knew what I was up to, of course, because timing my insults required a great deal of reconnaissance and planning. But he was so good-natured about it. Kamal's life, his dreams, and future ended when he was killed in the Iran-Iraq War. You cynically armed both sides of that awful conflict, switching sides back and forth to ensure that neither got the upper hand for long enough so that the fighting and inhumanity would continue as long as possible. Kamal was one of an estimated 1 million who perished in the fog of that war. When your local Lord Saddam Hussein became too powerful and Iraqi society perhaps too educated, you engineered a way to plunge them all into an incomprehensible hell. Your sadistic sanctions alone killed 500,000 Iraqi babies under the age of 5. Some of the ones that survived your barbarity are the rank and file of ISIS now. They are the ones who grew up without education because you bombed their schools, roads, and bridges. The ones who drank the water you polluted when you systematically destroyed their water system. The ones who nursed on the depleted uranium you spread throughout their land. The ones who grew up under the thumbs of your soldiers whose merciless cruelty you are still hiding. What we saw of Abu Ghraib we know was just the tip of the iceberg. You made ISIS. ISIS is your Frankenstein, not Islam's. They are your monsters that you unleashed into our tortured cities, into societies too broken now to perform the normal functions of marginalizing extreme elements. And we still do not know how ISIS is so well trained and so well armed. You destroyed Iraq. You reduced that ancient society, that birthplace of written language and mathematics, into a cauldron of internecine violence. You looted their museums and oil fields. You did the same thing to Libya. You made beggars of mothers and teachers and doctors and produced generations of illiterates into what were high-functioning cultured societies. I'm going to skip the next personal memory, but I could go on of what you've done and, of course, what you've made of Palestine. That once multicultural, multireligious, multi-ethnic land is now a place of exclusivity, supremacy, and entitlement for Jews at the terrible expense of non-Jews. A place of apartheid, multi-tiered laws based on religion, color-coded IDs, segregated roads and buses, of military occupation, guard towers, snipers, sweeping surveillance, systematic state theft, constant displacement, persistent day and night raids that drag people from their jobs and schools into torture dungeons. Palestine is the birth and life place of my ancient Jerusalem family, centuries of inhabiting At-Tur, and centuries more before that of inhabiting Deir al-Hawa in Jerusalem. But none of us is allowed to live there or inherit our birthright, because in the eyes of those who hold the guns, we are the wrong kind of human. We are exiled, occupied, or languishing in refugee camps so that every Jewish person from around the world can have an extra country. The devastation you have wrought on others is breathtaking. When refugees of the infernos you stoked managed to escape, grasping at the wind for some lifeline, you let them get swallowed by the sea. Or if you let them in, you congratulate yourselves endlessly for your charity, consign them to impoverishment, and simultaneously bemoan an immigrant problem. When you had destroyed, stripped, and raped so many of everything in this world, and they had nothing but their faith to give them a modicum of solace, you openly and publicly mocked what is sacred and holy to them, ascribed the most vile filth to their prophet, and in an inconceivable arrogance, you called it free speech. The Penn American Center even called it courageous. Dear Western world, I think I should end. I'm getting the end now, but I want to thank you all for listening to me. Thank you.
Okay, onward. We have more wonderful speakers. So let's move on to the next one. Our next speaker is Johnny Achi. Johnny is a Syrian-American peace activist and a founding member of Arab Americans for Syria, which is essentially a West Coast organization. He has been to Syria 7 times since the present crisis began in 2011, and he led a U.S. anti-war fact-finding delegation to Syria in September of 2013 at the height of the U.S. campaign to carry out a military strike. I remember that they went and interviewed the youth who were sitting outside the area that the U.S. had threatened to strike. So I hope Johnny's going to come up here. And I'm sure that you'll be interested in what he has to say.
Good morning. Thank you all for having me here. As been told, I'm founding member of Arab Americans for Syria, a group that we started together early on in the crisis when we realized what we were up against. We realized what's happening in Syria is not a revolution, far away from being a revolution. We realized they were trying to manufacture a revolution. We felt how the media, the vicious media campaign against Syria, not that just they're not presenting the other side of the story, but on the contrary, they were reversing the facts. Everything that was showing early on was nothing but the opposite of what's happening. Syrians have seen what happened in Iraq. We've lived it. We've seen what just had happened in Libya months earlier. We didn't want the same to happen to Syria. Syria was living its best days at the time. Yes, we wanted reforms. We supported reform. People were going in the millions in the street in support of the government reforms. Yet the media was only showing you the few hundreds that wanted to overthrow this government. They were the puppets for the United States to turn out Syria from being a resistive nation to a puppet nation. I will just briefly tell you what Turkish General Ismail Haki, he summarized it by saying, he's the chief of staff of the Turkish army. He said, Turkey has repeatedly asked Syria upon request from the West and Washington to let the Muslim Brotherhood into the government. When Assad refused, they moved to the armed rebellion, importing armed groups, mercenaries, and terrorists from all over the world to overthrow Assad by force. The Turkish and the Qataris wanted to pass the gas lines from Turkey to Qatar to Turkey. When Syria refused, of course, all hell was broken loose. Qatar and Saudi Arabia provided the propaganda early on. On Qatari TV, we heard call for jihad. We heard it in the mosques just before on Friday prayers, people asking for jihad. Jihad is a very difficult word, very dangerous word, people. When on Qatari TV, which had earned the trust of the Arabic viewers through the Palestinian crisis, when you hear in your home calling for Muslims around the world to come to Syria to fight the infidels, all Syrians have become infidels. Anybody who supports the Syrian government is an infidel. So what happened to democracy? Don't I have the right to fight or be on the side who I want to be? Suddenly, we were getting threats. All the Syrians' blood were spilled. If you were with the Syrian government, your blood is halal. Qatari Yusuf Qaldawi, the head of the Muslim Brotherhood, not only provided the necessary fatwa, which is a religious decree for fighters to come into Syria, but he also asked them to join the Islamic State and to start the Sharia law in Syria. This was the most dangerous thing that the West never reported. We were fighting mercenaries from all over the world. The Syrian army was not attacking civilians. The Syrian army was protecting cities. Any place that these mercenaries did not come in is still intact. Damascus, which is the most cosmopolitan of all the cities in Syria, has a mosaic of all the religions and different ethnic groups and sectarians. It's safe. They protect each other. There is no civil war in Syria. Otherwise, Damascus should have been lit on fire. On the contrary, Damascus, where 5 million live, the only problem in Damascus is our friends, what the Obama administration called moderate rebels. They're the ones who rain Damascus every single day for now almost 2.5 years with rocket-propelled grenades. This is the only thing that's happening in Damascus. No one talks about it. It's the most consistent thing in this war is this rocket-propelled grenade. We've lost families from these random rockets. How is not that terror? These are the moderate rebels that Obama wants to bring in instead of the secular government that we currently have in Syria. These people who have promised us that once they get in power, they're going to slaughter us. The only thing that's preventing them from doing so is the Syrian army.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.